Now, there is a lot more information out there about soil health today than there was, say, a decade ago or so. But it's still up to each individual farmer to figure out what works best for their operation.
We're starting to understand what different cover crops do to our soils. And we're starting to understand what different mixes and how different cover crop species mix together, how they interact with one another, and what they can do to benefit us on our farm and our particular soils, and what they can kind of bring to the table and help us to utilize some of our, well, our number one resource, which is our soil.
Jay Baxter shares about the cover crops, equipment, biosolids, poultry manure, and more that are all a part of his farm in Southern Delaware. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Today I'm sharing an energizing conversation I got to have with Delaware farmer Jay Baxter. Jay grows soybeans, corn, sweet corn, and lima beans on Baxter Farms in southern Delaware. He's a fourth generation to do so alongside his sister, who farms with him, as well as some other family stakeholders. That includes his 93-year-old grandmother, who's still engaged with the farm. In addition to the crops, they also have 8 chicken houses, so at any one time they have about 225,000 broilers on the farm. Now, that's enough to keep anyone busy, but Jay and his wife have also started a couple of side businesses, one being a greenhouse company growing contract potted flowers for a wholesale distributor, and a custom cover crop application business. Now, one interesting thing about Jay that came up in our conversation that's actually a little bit different than some of our other guests you've heard on the show so far is that he has included hairy vetch in his cover crop mix for about 20 years. He's heard about the problems and concerns that others have voiced about hairy vetch, and he says for him, every year is a little bit different, but they've learned to manage the cover crop in a way that has been very beneficial for their operation. We'll talk a little bit about that in today's episode. We also talk about the equipment Jay uses, how he's been able to utilize wastewater and biosolids on certain areas of his farm, where poultry fits into soil health, and so much more. To kick things off, Jay shares about the early farming experiences that led him to pursue new soil health building practices.
When I got out of college, we were farming a little bit less acreage than what we are right now. So that was, you know, roughly 2001, 2002, something like that. You know, we were working every single acre we owned, even our soybean ground, our wheat ground, whatever it may be we were growing. But we were working every single acre, you know, pulverizing it practically to oblivion. And there came a bit of an epiphany for me. And at that point in time, it was my uncle and I making making the decisions, and it was more him than I, just because of, you know, my inexperience, we'll say. But we were really struggling to kind of get any type of yield moving forward. And, you know, we had one farm in particular that had been, you know, everything we had at that point in time was a corn and soybeans rotation, but we were very heavy corn. And at that point in time, there was 7 or 8 years straight corn. Sandy piece of ground. It was irrigated, but all we could seem to yield out of that was about 125, maybe 150 bushels to the acre on irrigated ground. And I remember in the springtime, we'd have to irrigate to keep the sand from blowing away, which our elevations in some of our farms is in the single digits above sea level. So that's just how close we are. And so, you know, up until that year, we were having to irrigate in order to keep the sand from blowing off of our hills and sandblasting the young corn that was growing. And I got thinking, there's got to be something better that we can do than watching this stuff blow to the ocean and us giving away everything that we're working for. At the same time, we're also in a contract with a local municipality to spray irrigate effluent wastewater. And by state law, we had to always have something growing a green crop always growing. And so that's what kind of forced us to get started into cover cropping. And for the first few years of that, we were, you know, just doing whatever we could to fulfill the requirement. And that's when I started asking questions. You know, if we're forced to grow a cover crop, why don't we look into something that we can grow that will start to benefit our soil? And so I started asking some questions, got involved with a soil analytical consultant that we'd been using since the early 80s. And he kind of started getting me in contact with some other farmers in our region that are, you know, substantially cover cropping. And that changed my world. And kind of the rest is history, it seems. That one farm that was, you know, getting by at a measly 125 bushel to the acre is now, you know, pushing 250 to 270. This is quite sandy ground. We are growing a lot of hairy vetch and a lot of rye. We have tried all kinds of different cover crops, and there's no cover crop that I'm not willing to try or not willing to try again. And so that kind of open mind and change of mindset seemed to be what started to carry us forward. And now we're 100% no-till. And if time allows and manpower allows and equipment would allow, we would be 100% cover cropped. And we're starting to understand what different cover crops do to our soils. And we're starting to understand what different mixes and how different cover crop species mix together, how they interact with one another, and what they can do to benefit us on our farm and our particular soils, and what they can kind of bring to the table and help us to utilize some of our, well, our number one resource, which is our soil.
Wow, Jay, this is awesome. Can you maybe connect the dots in more detail between your decision to really ask some questions about how to make cover crops work for you and this incredible increase in yield that you've seen? Kind of what do you attribute that yield to?
Okay, so the increase in yields, you know, I've got to be completely honest. There was multiple things that changed at once. And anybody that's involved in science knows that you can't change multiple variables when doing an experiment. But when you're at rock bottom, something's got to give, right? And so to be able to identify multiple things that were wrong in our operation and be able to fix them immediately, or be able to change them immediately, I guess we didn't necessarily know that they were wrong. And that's something that I want to be very particular to say, that I would never and could never criticize previous generations for decisions they've made. You know, just like I hope that the next generation, whether it be my kids or whether it's my nieces and nephews or whether, you know, it's someone like that that comes along, I certainly hope that they could learn to make decisions for themselves and better this farming operation, because that's the whole purpose in us being here. And so I never want to be critical of the previous generation or generations, because at the time they were making the best decisions they knew how, and it was working for them. But through this in particular, what we're talking about, through, you know, low yields and not understanding how things work together, we were finally, I'll say, wearing ourselves out. So a part of it that I left out is family loss. So my father died my senior year in college, and my uncle, he died a few years after that. So someone who was, you know, fresh out of college and full of crazy ideas, the timing was miserable, right? Timing sucked. It couldn't have been worse timing, but the timing was perfect. If it had been, you know, 20 years ahead, which would be now, some of those decisions we would be so far behind on, and I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. And so that kind of ability to for me to make these decisions being thrusted forward, because here I was as a, you know, 22, 23 year old making multi-million dollar decisions because this thing was thrown in my lap and it was either figure this out or go broke. And we've been blessed to be able to figure this out.
Makes sense. Yeah. So today, we kind of talked about corn and soybeans, but then you also said you've got kind of sweet corn and lima beans in the rotation as well. Were those mostly decisions based on just kind of market opportunities, or was it strategic within sort of the rotation and the overall agronomic system?
Yeah, it was more like C, all of the above. So diversity is something that makes family farms work. And we are quite diverse. We were first diversified into the poultry. When I graduated college, we had a capacity of 450,000 chickens. That's a lot of chickens. We were also in the machinery business. We sold farm equipment for AGCO. My grandfather started selling Minneapolis Moline tractors. And so we were quite busy in different realms of life. The poultry operation kind of downsized due to the market, which was not necessarily a bad thing because that made us extremely busy. The machinery business, which mainly my father and one of my sisters operated that, and you know, obviously all of us on the farm helped where we could, but the day-to-day business decisions for the machinery dealership kind of fell on my father's shoulders. And so, you know, after his passing, my uncle and I and my grandfather kind of decided that, you know, we would prefer to farm. And so that kind of fizzled out on its own. You know, here we were trying to, you know, regroup ourselves. And soon after that is when my uncle developed a brain tumor, and, you know, that ultimately took him home as well. So here I was stuck with decisions to make and what we were going to do. And that was roughly the time of no-till and cover crops and what we're learning. And, you know, without the manpower, we soon learned that both of those were saving us money. Both of those opportunities in business, the no-till and the cover crops, were saving us money on our farming operation and allowing us to be more efficient. And we have that discussion locally quite often. Well, how come you're not working ground? Well, you know, we've changed our entire business model to no-till. It's not just a soil health thing. It's a business decision for us. And as we started to grow better and better corn and soybeans, it's almost like you need a new challenge in life, right? And it was always a dream of mine to diversify because we had kind of shrunk our diversification some. And so an opportunity came along through a friend, another mentor of mine, to grow sweet corn. And so we tried it and worked out quite well. Now, up until that point, we still were switching back and forth in certain acreage, you know, no-tilling it for a few years, growing cover crops for a few years, and then working the ground. And, you know, it was always said that anytime you grow vegetables, you have to work the ground because you have to cultivate. Well, we soon found that we don't have to cultivate. So therefore, why do we have to work the ground? There were some other farmers that were doing just that, and it was working out very well for them. And I took some of their advice and soon found that I no longer have to cultivate my sweet corn. And I no longer have to work the ground because there's technology in inputs that can overcome driving across the farm with a piece of steel. Our soil isn't iron deficient, I like to tell people. So why put iron into it? Then an opportunity came along for lima beans, and the same thing. Well, if you're going to grow lima beans, you got to rip the ground first because, you know, they need to put their roots down. Okay. The very first year we grew lima beans was the very first year my wife and I farmed on our own with our own piece of farmland that we had just bought. And after some, I'll say, bad advice, we planted into dust. And 3 days later, we had a 6-inch rain, and most of our lima beans washed into the ditch along with the soil that was with it. And it stayed extremely wet the rest of the year. So if not for the grace of God, we probably would have gone broke our very first year of farming, my wife and I. We soon found through trial and error that we could also skip the cultivation in lima beans, and therefore we could skip the tillage of ground in lima beans. And fast forward, let's say to year 4 or 5, I had convince the local freezer plant that we grew lima beans for to come out and look at our farming operation and what we were doing in corn and soybeans and sweet corn. And would they be willing to work with me on no-till and cover crops because of what I had proven that I could do in my other rotations? And they said, well, we think this is something of the future and we'd like for you to do it. That following year, we grew no-till lima beans and we grew them behind Hairy Vetch, which, let me back up a stack and brag on my Hairy Vetch. We can typically pencil in our crop needs for nitrogen. We can subtract 60 to 80 units of nitrogen per our crop needs. And so we were able to cut back on our inputs even more for those lima beans. And by having a live soil, by having a soil with good tilth, by having a soil with a cover crop root mat underneath of the processing lima beans, we had a major win that year. I don't remember the exact year, but there was two hurricanes that came up the coast within 10 days of each other, and both of those storms combined dumped 14 inches of rain on us, which anybody that lives on the East Coast, I know a lot of Midwestern farmers are always concerned about hail and always concerned about tornadoes and things like that. For us, this time of year, you know, here it is, today's the 31st of August. For those of you listening 10 years from now, it's the 31st of August, and a hurricane just came across Florida yesterday and is coming up the coast. Now, luckily for us, it is making a hard right, and it's going to miss us, and we've only got a breeze and a little bit of cool, cloudy weather. But those storms cause a panic for farmers in our region. That year, when we had those two storms dump 14 inches of rain on top of our lima bean crop, the machinery that was picking the lima beans, which are really, they're just pea viners that have been modified. So these viners are on the previous farm. So the viners, the harvesters are owned typically by the processor. And so they can dictate when they want to harvest in order to keep their processing plant full. And so I find out that they're coming to me and they have just left a farm that they could not finish harvest because every single machine was stuck multiple times and they had to have wreckers there to drag them out of the field back onto the blacktop. So I was a little concerned that they were coming to my no-till fields and what things would look like. So after getting stuck, I think they said the number was about 16 times in a 50-acre parcel, they came to me and they didn't make a rut. Fast forward that winter, I got a phone call from the owner of the processing plant. He said, I need you to come in and see me, which was a local processor, so it wasn't hard. So I stopped in a few days later. He said, I need you to sit down in my office. So we got talking. He goes, whatever you did last year with growing lima beans, we want you to do it again. And then he had this smirk on his face. I said, well, okay, well, I'd be glad to. He goes, whatever you did, he said, you're the only farmer out of all the growers that we have on the thousands of acres of beans that we picked. You're the only farmer that grew 100% A-grade beans for that year. So we as a grower are graded on A, B, and C grade beans. A obviously is the highest paying bean, but that's green beans with no blemish. So our beans, being they were sitting in very damp conditions, but because they were sitting on top of a mulch as opposed to sitting on top of bare soil, they had no blemish on them and therefore were A-grade beans, and that's what the processor really wanted. So we immediately became no-till and cover crop farming lima bean growers.
Man, that is cool. I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is about the wastewater. You know, you were required to grow cover crops because of the wastewater program. Is that program still going on? And is that considered, I mean, do you also do biosolids as well? Or what does that look like, kind of bringing those nutrients into your farming operation?
So wastewater and biosolids was a monster that I inherited. And we have learned to make that work. So I need to be very specific as well here to let everyone know that these two things we've talked about, vegetables, you know, vegetables that go for human consumption and wastewater and biosolids are kept completely separate. It is against the law to grow anything for human consumption under biosolids or under the treated effluent that we actually spray, apply on our farm. It's a state law for us, and it has to be 3 years removed before you can go back to anything human consumption. So because of the vegetables that we have gotten into, that's actually restricted where we grow that part of our operation. And it has kind of forced our hand in a very good way. So we've kept the wastewater application very specific to certain lands, which coincidentally and also not by accident, I don't believe in coincidences, even though I keep saying coincidentally, but purposefully, our farm is nestled right near a wastewater treatment plant for a local municipality. The relationship began before that with biosolids because we were applying the biosolids from that treatment plant. And as they grew and as regulations changed and as we started to learn the needs of the environment and some of our ways could be done more efficiently in regards to treating and disposing of wastewater, we soon found that we had a resource shared between us, between the wastewater and us, the farmer with the land and the pivots, that there was an opportunity there. So it's kind of become a mutual working business relationship between us and the local town. The application of biosolids has since gone away for us. I don't see that ever changing into the future just because there's so many hurdles that are required by our local regulations, but there's also hurdles that I, as the farmer, have put in place. It's very difficult to apply biosolids in a no-till operation. And there's companies out there that have done the work and there's equipment that will apply it. But it seems that the applicators that would custom apply the biosolids are not interested. And they have actually stopped doing work in practically our entire region. And a lot of that's forced to be done elsewhere. Most of the biosolids now are being dewatered. They're being cooked and dewatered and are being mixed with lime. And it's working out great for other farms, but you know, it's just not something that we're interested in because of our vegetable restrictions. So
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. No, I appreciate you clearing that up. And yeah, it's an important distinction there. But so you still are able to use the wastewater though, just of course, not on anything for human consumption.
Correct. We are spraying wastewater, treated effluent wastewater. We are spraying that on roughly 300 acres right now through center pivot irrigation. And that's all within a mile and a half of the local wastewater treatment plant.
And you mentioned equipment there just a minute ago. I'm curious, what equipment has enabled you to develop your system into what it is today? You mentioned the rollers that you're using for the hairy vetch, but any other equipment that, you know, over the years has been a game changer for you in the way that you're able to farm?
Sure. And it's nothing drastic. It's nothing off the wall. You know, there's equipment manufacturers out there that are all the time coming up with new things, and there's farmers all the time being used as experiments on this equipment that's being developed. So it's nice to get to know some of those farmers. Shout out to Lauren Steinlage. He's quite the guy when it comes to experimenting on his farm with different brands of equipment manufacturing, different ideas, and tearing something down and building it back up into something that works well. But you know, as we started to invest in newer equipment, we start to design it for our no-till and for our cover crops. And as we continue to mellow out our soil and continue to depend on these cover crops, we're learning that our equipment may have to be modified even more. So let's go over a planter, for instance. Rolling down the cover crop for a few seasons, we have found that it is unnecessary. And there's still a considerable amount of corn that we plant that we don't roll down our vetch anymore. We have taken our no-till coulters. We don't have a planter with no-till coulters on it anymore. We make sure we utilize down pressure to get that seed placement exactly where we want it, but we utilize row cleaners in order to clear the residue and clear the cover crop out of the way of that row unit so we can get that seed placement exactly where we want it. Again, I know that we try not to, in these discussions, talk about, you know, one brand versus another, but there are brands that don't work, and the one brand that does work that we have found is Yetter. Yetter Shark's Tooth Row Cleaner is the best we have found on the market with a treader wheel to move these cover crops out of the way, specifically the hairy vetch. Now, it's not perfect. And so that's what I've got to remind everybody. Every year is different. You know, 3 or 4 years in a row, man, that worked great for us. And then we started realizing that we're not closing up our seed trench properly. So now what? Well, come to find out that we had mellowed out our soil and we had such a root mat in that soil that we could move the residue off the top. We could slice the ground. We could place that seed at exactly 2 inches of depth, but we couldn't close up the trench anymore because of those living roots that were kind of sticking together. So that's when we abruptly had to change the type of closing wheels we were running on the planter. So it seems that every year I'm trying a different closing wheel, and I still haven't found one that's perfect. But I found a combination of some that work well, and it was quite interesting to our exact point in this conversation that, you know, rubber closing wheels were the best thing out there for a long time for our farm. And we found that we outgrew them, right? They no longer work for us. And so that's why we have to be fluid in everything we do. And there's times now where we have found if we let the hairy vetch get too mature, like in the times of growing lima beans or growing late corn or growing multiple species of cover crops together that might try to vine on each other or vine onto standing corn stalks, that we found that they like to wrap up. And even that row cleaner that I just mentioned, the Yetter Shark's Tooth Row Cleaner with treader wheels, they still wrap up. I've had representatives from the manufacturer out, and we've tossed around ideas, and we've poked holes in ideas, and they've come back to me and said, we'll try this, and some of those suggestions worked, and we're still having issues from time to time. And that's just part of doing what we do. We've come to accept the fact that some of what we're doing is not the most efficient thing out there, but when you put pencil to paper, it all comes down to bottom line, and we're still winning tremendously. Now, there has been opportunities where we've had no choice, or it is a necessity, or something we found out works best for our efficiency, that we go across our cover crop, regardless of what it may be, we go across our cover crop with vertical tillage. We coincidentally have a Kraus accelerator, and the reason we like it is it's the ability to adjust the angle of the blades, ability to adjust the depth, and the ability to allow things to be modified at all different places. And I think other manufacturers do the same now, but that's just what we have on our farm. And every year, that piece of farm equipment gets utilized in the spring, not on every acre, but on some of our acreage. Now, I know there may be some naysayers out there that probably listen to your podcast to say, well, that's tillage. Well, okay, let's split hairs. That's fine.
Yeah, and I think it goes right with the theme that we've talked about a lot, which is you have a system here, and that system is going to require different tools for different jobs at different times. And we're not going to get so dogmatic about right and wrong that we're going to say someone calls that tillage, and so it's against the rules. It's not against the rules. You know, it's what works for the system overall. And I like what you said there about efficiency, about, you know, sometimes a practice taken on its own might look at and say, that's not the most efficient way to do things. But overall with the system, if that's what's generating you the best returns, then, you know, you got to do it, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And we had that situation this year, right? I planted 100 plus acres of lima beans, and I had the last 25 acres left to go. and overnight it rained, and it completely changed the dynamics of how my planter worked in the conditions that I was already set up for. And so it was either we had to figure out something in the next 2 hours, or we were going to miss the planting window, because the planting window all depends on, you know, 3 months into the future of what the harvest window looks like. And so if we don't get it planted in a timely manner, those other acres get bypassed and we have to figure out something. And in the middle of June, we're kind of running out of options. So sometimes we're forced to pivot. And that's the one thing I can say about, I think, farmers in general, is we sometimes have to adapt and overcome. And I think we're really good at that.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to talk about the chickens before we go. Are you able to integrate the chicken operation with the row crop operation in terms of nutrients, using the manure for compost or any sort of application there?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a very good question. And hopefully we can squeeze this in the time that we have. So our poultry operation, we utilize the manure that comes off of it. Actually, poultry manure is so valuable to us that there are entire businesses in our region that's all they do is operate in the poultry litter world. So it is a commodity for us. We're buying and selling in our local regional agriculture. We utilize every single pound of poultry manure that comes off of our farm, and we actually buy more on the market. And we are able to spread that. Now, regulations would have it in our region, and this is all kind of morphed over, you know, a couple of generations now, but due to environmental concerns, regulations have come down that limit the amount of phosphorus that we can apply on our soils. Our soils are hereditarily high in phosphorus. So on our extremely high phosphorus soils, we can only apply a 2-year crop removal rate of phosphorus, which is, you know, one of the ingredients in poultry manure. And there's been some breakthroughs, we'll call them breakthroughs, and some may argue with me about that point. There's been some breakthroughs in poultry feed, some additives added to poultry feed that actually ties up that phosphorus. And, you know, as the bird eats that additive in the feed, it allows that phosphorus to be bound and no longer mobile, which is what really we're after, is trying to keep the phosphorus from mobilizing through the soil into the surface waters and into the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, this is the driver of everything we do here, is the poultry industry and the Chesapeake Bay. And so these are rules that have come about in the last 10 or 15 years or so. And that's to try to mitigate the amount of phosphorus that's becoming a pollutant. And we in agriculture, we're winning. We really are winning. We're becoming more efficient. We're learning that certain ways aren't the best practices. We're learning the best management practices. And one of these is the cover crops. And the other one is the no-till. And we're learning that we can now credit ourselves for helping to clean up the environment and helping to clean up the runoff by utilizing no-till and utilizing cover crops. And we're quite proud of that. And luckily, in our states of Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia, we are able to take credit for that and move forward with it.
Wow, what a strong place to end this episode right there. Very thought-provoking words from Jay. One quick thing that I think I'll just add here is when I asked Jay for his take-home message for other farmers, it was one that might sound a little familiar because it has come up before. It's simply to try something, just on a small scale. Pick something and just try it and give it more than just a year to really identify what's working and what may not be working that can be tweaked to move forward. Then he said, don't be afraid to change a little bit. Thank you again so much to Jay Baxter for taking the time to be on our show today. Before we close, I'd like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayouette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute.
If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe to and follow this show on your favorite podcast app and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website at farmersforsoilhealth.com. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.